Thanks for being with us on The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. The weekday afternoon lineup here on the Ideas Network is changing. Science Friday stays the same. And starting next week, Monday through Thursday, we'll hear an hour of On Point at 1 o'clock, and then The Takeaway airs at 2. The Takeaway is a national daily news program, and the focus is to bring together perspectives and experiences from across the country. Tanzina Vega hosts The Takeaway. I talked with her earlier this week. What kinds of conversation can people hear when they listen to The Takeaway?
One of the things that I grounded the show in when I started as host was there were three gaps in American society that really inform all of the reporting that we do. And what I mean by that is there is an empathy gap, there is a wealth gap, and there is a truth gap. And what we aim to do is ground all of our work with that in the background, understanding how we can close some of these gaps. So a lot of our work focuses on the news of the day, but it's not just telling you what just happened. What we're trying to do is offer you some analysis, some insight, some nuance, and some depth to what you're already probably inundated by in more commercial media. So that's essentially the type of conversation that we're trying to have. And we're also trying to make sure that the people that we interview are diverse in and of themselves when we're talking about points of view. Not always, you know, we have everybody from folks at the New York Times to, you know, people in local communities weighing in on what they think. And a big portion of the show is also our listeners.
Yeah. How much does audience participation play into these shows?
Audience participation is key, and there are many different ways that we ask for people to join us in the conversation. One of the ways, and you'll hear me talking about this every day on the show, is they can just call us. We'd love to hear from our listeners. Our number is 877-8-MY-TAKE. That line is open for you to call us pretty much about anything. We often ask listener questions on social media. We ask people to call us in terms of what they're thinking of the news of the day. And for those who really want to stay connected with The Takeaway at a more in-depth level, we also have a text messaging network. And that will allow producers and people on our team to reach out to folks and say, hey, you know, are you interested in weighing in on this particular topic? People who want to engage with the show that way can text START, S-T-A-R-T, to the number 69866.
Tanzina Vega hosts The Takeaway. It's coming to the Ideas Network starting Monday, and you can listen at 2 o'clock in the afternoon every Monday through Thursday. Tanzina, Wisconsin has had some experiences with journalists from the coast not taking time to understand what life is like here. How do you make sure that you're talking about, that you're talking with everyone in the country?
Well, again, that's another big part of The Takeaway. I used to be a national reporter at The New York Times. And when I did that, particularly covering the issue of race in this country, one of the most important things to do was not to stay in New York and to make sure that we're getting out across the country and traveling across the country. Right now, obviously, with the coronavirus, we're limited in where we can be physically. Before that, we were making sure that we were visiting sister stations across the country and doing reporting on the ground at those places. We, you know, really try not to to have that sort of coastal bias that I think a lot of folks, you know, might be a little bit more myopic on, and really try to make sure that we are getting people from those communities to talk to us and not just taking the sort of 35,000 foot view about what's happening.
You mentioned your career focused on reporting on race and inequality. What's different now than when you've reported on those issues in the past?
Well, I think one of the things I often think about is when I pitched this idea at the New York Times, it was before the killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. And so the issues that we were thinking about then, I think, had not really reached the fever pitch in the public consciousness as far as the, you know, criminal justice reform and other things, you know, systemic inequality, the racial wealth gap. And they were things that I think people were talking about, mostly in academic or activist circles, but they hadn't really reached the kitchen table of most Americans. If you fast forward to today, to 2020, and we look at what has happened with the rise of the, you know, the uprising for racial justice across the country, how the movement for Black Lives and and Black Lives Matter has morphed into something that is no longer, you know, ignored by top political candidates, whether they're for it or against it. If you look at the conversations that so many people are having today who are saying things like, you know, systemic inequality, who are invoking those types of that type of language, that tells me that there has been a shift in the awareness of so many of these issues that that Americans, you know, may or may not have wanted to talk about. I think another thing that's shifted is we're talking about, you know, almost a decade of work that I've been doing in this space. And, you know, social media has evolved significantly in that time. And so we're now, you know, a lot of these issues, especially when we're talking about police brutality, a lot of these issues aren't new. What they are is that they're being shown. We are seeing these things playing out. Our consciousness, I think, has been altered in many ways, and it's forcing us to really adjust our lens and not be able to ignore what we may have been able to just sweep under the rug, you know, a decade or two ago.
Last year, you mentioned that you were inspired by journalist Christiane Amanpour saying that she tries to be truthful, not neutral. Why does that resonate with you?
I think one of the things that journalists have been accused of, and I think this was one of the tenets of journalism, at least in its traditional form, is this idea of objectivity. And so there was a need, I think many journalists, in particular younger journalists, may have felt to, if we interview this person, then we must interview that person who has the opposing view. That can only take you so far. And I think, as I mentioned at the top of our conversation, one of the things that the takeaway is really looking at is the truth gap, you know, between, and which I think is quite, you know, almost unprecedented for many of us who've never really dealt with this level of bending of the truth, of lying, you know, coming from, you know, our presidential administration, coming from the sources that we get on social media, you know, things that news articles that we thought might, you know, our trust in the media has been shaken. And so I think that right now it's paramount to be able to say we can't just, you know, it's no longer business as usual. The stakes have changed. And the cards that we're all playing with have changed, and we need to be able to adapt to that. And the only way to do that is to remain in some areas, you know, truthful. And that may mean, you know, we don't necessarily have an A and or B conversation. Not everything is as simple as that. And it requires longer conversations. It requires more depth. And that's where I think it's simpler to remain neutral, quote unquote, if you're trying to just, you know, posit A against B. It's much more difficult to try and get to a place of authentic, you know, reality for what's really happening on the ground. And I think that's what the takeaway is striving to do, while at the same time, you know, maintaining its editorial and journalistic standards.
We will certainly be listening. Tanzina, thank you for your time.
We are so excited, Wisconsin. Thank you for having us, and we hope to serve you well.
That was the Takeaway host, Tanzina Vega. You can hear the Takeaway right here on the Ideas Network. It starts Monday. Just tune in Monday through Thursday at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And for a list of all of the program changes here at WPR, you can visit our website. Go to WPR.org/fall2020. Up next, overdose deaths are trending up. It's an epidemic already gripping the country before COVID-19 came onto the scene. And it seems it's only getting worse. We're learning more about the circumstances ahead here on The Morning Show. I'm Keeley Boltina, and this is the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina. More people are dying this year in Wisconsin, and it's not just from COVID-19. Officials report the number of drug overdose deaths is steady, and it's on track to set a record again. Edgar Mendez is a senior staff writer for the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service, and he and I talked about what projections show for 2020.
You learned that Milwaukee County's first drug overdose victim in May was 21 years old. What killed her?
Well, she died of a combination of drugs. One of them was fentanyl, which seems to be one of the main factors in terms of drugs that kill people. But she also was using Tramadol, which is a painkiller, and a designer drug. So she died of a combination of drugs, which is also pretty common.
And she's just one of dozens of people who've died of overdoses this year. What does the trend look like in Milwaukee?
Well, the trend of overdose deaths in Milwaukee has been pretty steady. So there's been around 40 overdose deaths a month so far, but there also is a good number of unconfirmed cases. So those numbers will definitely go up, and we're definitely on pace right now to not just pass last year's record high of 418 in Milwaukee County, but pass it by a significant number, could even reach 600.
600 people in 1 year dying of overdoses just in Milwaukee County.
That's correct.
People make assumptions, make judgments about who dies of a drug overdose. It's race, income, where they live. What did you find out about the people who've died from overdoses this year?
Right. And not just this year, but over the past few years, I've been covering the issue of drug overdose deaths and looking a lot closely at opioid overdose deaths for the past few years. And each year, the victims become more diverse. So while maybe a few years ago, it was more of a suburban white problem, now about 28%, 30% of the victims are African-American, nearly 15% Hispanic, and other races. So it's almost 50-50 right now. So that might surprise some people. And the majority of the victims were actually residents of the city of Milwaukee and not the suburbs.
So it's really happening all over.
Definitely happening all over. I mean, there was about six different zip codes in Milwaukee that had more than 10 overdose victims.
Is this Milwaukee's issue, or are other parts of the state seeing more overdoses?
No, it's definitely a statewide, not just a statewide, but a national increase that's going on right now. I know that I've seen that in Kenosha, they're having the same issue. Appleton, I believe Dane County has seen an uptick in overdose deaths. So I don't think that there's many areas of the state that haven't been touched by this issue.
Edgar Mendez is a reporter for the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service, and we're talking about his piece for Wisconsin Watch on overdose deaths in Wisconsin. The number is rising. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Edgar, Appleton police note that they saw more deaths in April and May. At that time, communities were restricted, activities shut down, only the most essential services operating. Did that contribute to this rise in overdose deaths?
I believe, talking to people who work with drug abuse, who work with people who suffer from drug abuse, they talk about isolation being a factor in terms of people isolating and using drugs. So with this isolation that was, forced isolation, it kind of created a perfect environment for people to get deeper into their drug use. And not even just the isolation factor, but just the stress, the increased unemployment, the lack of ability to go to group meetings or to access the substance abuse services that they had been using prior to the pandemic. When they kind of lost those safety nets, a lot of people turned back to substance abuse, and as a result, we're seeing an increase in overdose deaths and a decrease in access to substance use services.
Talk a little bit more about unemployment, because even if you were able to go to a job, you still had all of those other pressures. Now, if you have lost work, not only are you losing income, but you also have hours of time when you're used to being productive, and now you don't get paid for it.
Right. I mean, being unemployed is stressful for anyone, But for someone who maybe is in recovery or was still struggling, now they're faced with the stress of having to pay bills and have responsibilities without having a job. And like you mentioned, just all the free time on their hand. And it's not exactly the free time that anybody wants. I don't think you could speak with anyone and they wouldn't say that this quarantine and just the stress of the COVID-19 pandemic has been a good time to be at home. I think everyone's feeling that same pressure, and it's just about it just creates the right environment for someone to kind of slide on their rehabilitation.
Yeah, because it's work every day. We know that resources are a constant challenge. How are communities responding to this increase in overdoses?
Well, I know that as far as, you know, just the substance abuse providers, many of them transitioned their services to online, with mixed results. Some people, I mean, it's better than nothing, but a lot of people in recovery, they thrive on having that human interaction. As far as what the city has done, there has been an increase in funding in the Milwaukee area to support some programming to kind of tackle this epidemic locally. One of the programs is called the MORI program, and that's a collaboration between the Milwaukee Fire Department and the Milwaukee Health Department. And what that program, the Milwaukee Overdose Response Initiative, did is it has substance abuse or peer counselors ride along with paramedics, and they talk with people who overdose and who are resuscitated. So they kind of reach out to the people who are at the highest risk for suffering a fatal overdose and try to get them help at that crucial time.
So there's dedication of some funding for rehabilitation. Do you know of any additional funds for those emergency responders? That's time, that's staffing, that's, items and drugs and materials that you have to respond to these calls with.
Well, I know that there's been funds over the last few years that are used to increase the availability of Narcan. But as far as specific to those first responders, I don't know of anything specific. I know that they're really stretched out right now with just everything else that they're dealing with. And it's just this all hands on deck approach is kind of compromise when we're going through a pandemic, which is challenging everything else as well.
What are advocates doing to try to keep people who are in recovery on track right now and well during this outbreak and everything that comes with it?
Well, I mean, they're just reaching out, just trying to keep touching base, whether it be via social media, whether it be in-person visits or just calling them over the phone. I think that just checking in with them and just letting them know that they aren't alone, that they are not isolated, and that that there are alternatives out there to deal with the stressors right now, and just kind of keeping them encouraging them to stay clean.
Is there anything else you want people to realize as you've been reporting on drug overdoses in Milwaukee and throughout Wisconsin?
I would just encourage them to reach out for services that may not have been available during the initial stages of the pandemic, but that may be returning. So I know that there are some group counseling sessions and other therapy sessions that are restarting again. And there are also online services. The Addiction Policy Forum has an online app to help people deal with, to support people in recovery during the COVID-19 pandemic. So I encourage them just not give up and to reach out for help wherever they can.
Edgar, thank you.
Thank you.
That was reporter Edgar Mendez. We discussed Edgar's article on overdose deaths. A version of it was originally published by the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service, and it's also posted on Wisconsin Watch. We've set up a link to the article on our website. You can find it at WPR.org/mornings. For months, community leaders around the United States have been talking about how these pressures of the pandemic and lockdowns could make life difficult for people already struggling. Job loss and economic strife are adding to the stress and trauma, and that means people in recovery might struggle more. Public health officials are also concerned for people's mental health. The number for the National Suicide Prevention Hotline is 800-273-TALK. That's 800-273-8255. People are ready to talk with you right now. Up next is news. Then, with more evictions on the horizon, organizations are trying to figure out how to provide shelter to a larger homeless population this fall and winter. And that's especially as social distancing reduces capacity at their facilities. That's still to come here on the Ideas Network. Join us. Call 800-642-1234 right now, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Let's talk about what your experiences are like. Maybe you volunteer at a homeless shelter, or maybe you've had to use programs. If you've been homeless, what happened? Share your story with us at 800-642-1234. I'm Keely Boltina. This is The Morning Show. News is next. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Next week, we're getting some new neighbors. That's right. 1A is moving in next door to The Morning Show. Starting Monday, you can hear 1A, hosted by Jen White, live at 9 o'clock in the morning. On Point is moving to 1 in the afternoon. And we're also welcoming a new show to the schedule. It's called The Takeaway, and it airs at 2. We hope you'll take a listen. Let us know what you think. Find complete details on our website at wpr.org/fall2020. Thanks for being with us on The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer Kent. Thousands of people who live in Wisconsin don't have secure housing. And while it's difficult to say whether more people are homeless now than before the pandemic began, we know evictions are up. And people who've lost jobs might not be able to afford a safe place to stay. We're talking about homelessness in the era of COVID-19 and how advocates are trying to support people when this disease is contagious and we're asked to keep our distance. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What resources have you turned to? Are you worried about losing your housing? Maybe you've been in a position where you can help a family member or a friend. What are you seeing when it comes to housing insecurity? 800-642-1234. Michael Bassford is the director of the Wisconsin Interagency Council on Homelessness. The council brings together 8 state agencies to prevent and end homelessness in Wisconsin. Michael, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me on.
Before the pandemic, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development came out with a report that shows, compared to the year before, Wisconsin saw a more than 7% decrease in the number of people who were homeless on a single night. That's how they do the count. Does that reflect what you're seeing?
Well, there are different ways to count homelessness in Wisconsin. HUD does a point-in-time count where communities go out throughout the country on a night in January and count the number of people who are in shelters and who are on the street and in transitional housing. And that's one way to count it. You can count it cumulatively throughout the year. But you know, the numbers, as far as I can see, pre-pandemic were rather stable. So, I mean, HUD calls it a slight decrease, and the point time numbers do show a slight decrease, but on any given night in Wisconsin, pre-pandemic, you could count on about 4,500 people throughout the state being homeless.
And you mentioned pre-pandemic numbers. Obviously, coronavirus struck. We had a statewide moratorium on evictions that was put into place. And then that ended in late May. How have we seen that change our homelessness in Wisconsin?
So prior to the pandemic, let's just go back there for a second. I mean, homelessness systems were already stressed and historically underfunded. And if you went to communities throughout the state and went to emergency shelters, you would find them in buildings that were not originally designed and built to serve as emergency shelters. And that's very important because one of the largest factors in the changes of homelessness during the time of COVID is that because of those emergency shelters as they were built, it was very difficult and in a couple of cases impossible to be able to shelter people with social distancing. Communities around Wisconsin had to come up with very creative solutions, find other locations to do emergency sheltering, do what is called non-congregate sheltering, which was to rent out a whole lot of hotel and motel rooms to put families in and people who were of the vulnerable population and also for people who may have become symptomatic or even come down with COVID. So for emergency sheltering, that's one thing. Yes, the economic downturn has had a very worrying effect on renters in Wisconsin. Thousands and thousands of renters throughout the state were not able to pay the rent. And you're right, we had a 60-day moratorium on rental evictions. After that, the state stood up a program of $25 million, the Wisconsin Rental Assistance Program, which is still ongoing. And that is serving people and keeping people in housing. But yes, as the economic downturn continues, we'll have to continue to contend with people who are who have economic issues who aren't able to pay the rent.
We're talking with Michael Baspert, who's the director of the Wisconsin Interagency Council on Homelessness. We're talking about what it looks like to not have stable housing during a pandemic. And we're taking your calls. There's a line for you at 800-642-1234. What is your experience with housing insecurity? Are you worried about what would happen if you lost your home? Maybe you're getting help from family members or friends. Maybe you've been able to offer some help. Perhaps you work in an industry where you help people connect with housing or with the resources that Michael is talking about. Let's talk about what you see at 800-642-1234. And Michael, as we're talking about those emergency shelters and social distancing, are shelters still able to take in the same number of people? Are they able to rent those hotel rooms or keep them well spaced out? Or is this actually affecting the number of people who can gain access to these resources?
Well, many communities in Wisconsin have been able to serve the same number of people and even serve more people. Some communities have not had that ability. So it varies from community to community.
How about the closures of libraries and other public buildings? We know that people who don't have a safe place to stay often spend time in places, especially when it's so hot, that are public places that are air conditioned. And now those places aren't allowing people in.
Yeah, that is, of course, troubling and will continue to be a concern, particularly as we get into winter, because we don't see this going away anytime soon. So we are concerned about that. Some communities have stepped up with creating cooling centers and places for people to go. But that is an ongoing concern.
Well, and then as you mentioned, winter, and you look toward it, we've heard Joe Volk, who's the executive director of the Wisconsin Coalition Against Homelessness, say he expects a tsunami of evictions and homelessness in September. And that isn't even getting us into those winter months. So how are shelters preparing for this?
Well, they are continuing to do non-congregate sheltering. Communities are doing that, and they are using other locations and looking for more locations and continuing to plan as we get into the winter. However, the issue still stands that, you know, while we do have a rental assistance program that has kept thousands of households in Wisconsin in their housing, the economic conditions are still going to continue. We don't see an end in sight for that. We are going to need more assistance, particularly from the federal government. Now, we have received significant funds already, and the state is turning them around and getting them out there. But that's only going to last for so long. Whether it's going to be a tsunami in September or in November, that's going to remain to be seen. But without additional help, ultimately, those funds are going to be spent, and then, you know, people are still going to need help and are not going to get it.
Wisconsin's Department of Workforce Development, part of your council, there's been a backlog of unemployment insurance claims. What effect have you seen that have on homelessness in our state?
The biggest effect has been for the people who are in housing who cannot keep up with their rental payments. We have been in communication with landlords, and a couple of legislators have really helped out in communicating with apartment associations. We're essentially, what we're talking with landlords about is that, you know, unemployment applications are, you know, if they're pending, if rental assistance applications are pending, you know, to be patient. And by and large, they are. And just know that that help is coming. I mean, things are getting better in terms of Department of Workforce Development is processing the applications for unemployment insurance, but it's just been an unprecedented amount of applications and people needing help. So that has been a big struggle and a big challenge.
We're talking with Michael Basford, who's the director of the Wisconsin Interagency Council on Homelessness. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Are people you know suddenly without a place to stay? How are you seeing communities support them? Maybe you're worried about losing your housing, or housing is secure for you now, but you've experienced being homeless in the past. What do you want people to understand about what that's like and how it works? 800-642-1234. There's a line for you at that number, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Keely Boltina. We're still talking about it here on The Morning Show, and this is the Ideas Network. When we talk to people about being homeless, we hear something often. They never expected to be here, sleeping in their car or without a secure place to call home. But life happens. They lose income, families break up, someone fears for their safety or has one health issue, and suddenly their entire world has changed. We're talking about homelessness now on The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina. Our guest is Michael Basford. He's the director of the Wisconsin Interagency Council on Homelessness. And your story is welcome here on the Ideas Network. You can call 1-800-642-1234. We've got Vicki in Oshkosh who's ready to join the conversation. Hi, Vicki.
Hi.
What's your story?
So I work for a property management company, and while we're headquartered out of Oshkosh, but we have 1,400 properties throughout Wisconsin. So we're in 12 different counties, and I handle the eviction end of the tenant process. And we've been working with the various CAP agencies in the different counties, like NewCAP, AdvoCAP, with that RAP program, the Rental Assistance Program. And it works. If tenants just call, get on the wait list, talk to somebody, you know, make that initial call. It's working. And then explain to your landlord that you did apply for RAP and hopefully they'll be patient, you know, and work with you. Like, we've kept so many people out of the eviction status because of the RAP program. It's just been a godsend.
Oh, Vicki, I know there are not all property managers or landlords are willing to do that, and it's good to hear that what you're doing works. Are you seeing more people in this circumstance? Are you dealing with more situations of eviction?
Absolutely. It's escalated since COVID started and after the moratorium lifted. It's been insane. Excuse me.
Well, Vicki, thank you for, yeah, please go ahead.
And so the RAP program is working. So I don't know if your guests can direct them to the website. I know it's on our website. We have a link to the page where you can call depending on what county you're in, and that's bluefrogpm.com. There's a big red box that says COVID rental assistance.
It's good to hear that your organization is working on that. And we've got a link at our website, too, if you want to go to wpr.org/mornings. And Michael, Vicki here is talking about that rental assistance program. And Governor Evers' $25 million statewide emergency rental program, it's available. Vicki says it's working, but it isn't necessarily meeting the demands of thousands of people in need. That's according to a report from Wisconsin Watch. Black residents in Milwaukee have been especially hard hit. What's happening here?
Well, first and foremost, I absolutely want to thank Vicki for calling in and for the work that she's doing. Again, I mean, landlords and property managers who are willing to work with their tenants who are in crisis are very, very important and a really important part of this solution to keep people into housing. To date, the rental assistance program has spent over $12 million. We've served over 6,200 households, and that's keeping people out of eviction court. But you're absolutely right. I mean, there are communities that have, some communities have a higher need than others, and locally, those communities have stepped up. Milwaukee County and the city of Milwaukee County have stood up their own rental assistance programs as well. And they've put millions of dollars into keeping their residents out of eviction court. But you're right, there is still an ongoing need for that. We're going to need more funding, more assistance. You know, it's been 4 months since the CARES Act passed. The CARES Act is what's paying for RAP. And the CARES Act is what's paying for what's going to be about $32 million worth of emergency solutions grants from the Department of Housing and Urban Development that we'll be able to put into solutions to help people stay in homes, but also help people who are experiencing homelessness in Wisconsin, particularly as a result of COVID. It's just going to be necessary that more assistance has to come. So hopefully Congress and the president can come up with another stimulus package that will bring more funds to help people out. But yeah, we're in communities where there is more, where there's a greater need. Dane County also has put in $10 million for rental assistance and has also helped a lot of households stay in housing, and the city of Racine as well. But yeah, I mean, there is going to be an ongoing need, and in some places in the state, it's higher. The demand is higher than others.
We're talking to Michael Basford, who heads up the Wisconsin Interagency Council on Homelessness, and you're listening to The Morning Show. Michael, when I hear you say there's more need and that money has to come in, resources have to come in, what happens if no one comes through, if the feds don't add more money, if the state or communities can't contribute more to help people who are homeless?
Well, it stands to reason that if that assistance doesn't continue And if the economy doesn't magically improve to the point where it could support people in housing, then yes, you're going to see that tsunami of evictions. And that is going to, you know, that is going to be a disaster.
What does Wisconsin's need for affordable housing look like then?
Oh, the need is massive. It was before the pandemic. It certainly is ongoing. I started this position in May of last year. And before stay at home, safer at home, what I would do is I would go all around the state to communities, talking with agencies, talking with people who are working on the ground, talking with community leaders. And whether it was whatever the size of the city or township or village, in urban and rural areas and in between, from Superior to Kenosha, I had I would hear the exact same thing. And that is the number one barrier for homeless people to get out of homelessness and into housing has been the availability of affordable housing. Communities in the state have to invest more in developing and converting properties into places where people who, you know, who may not be making the median income in their counties can afford to live. And until we really, and if you go to the National Low Income Housing Coalition and see their annual reports, I mean, they project a shortage in the tens of thousands of units for that are going to be needed for that. If you look at the state of California and you see all of the problems that they're having with homelessness, that has been a result of a housing market that's gone out of control, where you'll find broken down garages being sold for millions of dollars and counties having larger numbers of homeless people than the entire state of Wisconsin. If we don't get a grasp on the affordable housing crisis that we're facing here, that could be our future. And so it is of extreme importance that we get very serious about the development of affordable housing in Wisconsin.
Michael, thank you for your time talking with us on this.
Thank you.
Michael Bassford is the director of the Wisconsin Interagency Council on Homelessness. The council brings together 8 state agencies to try to prevent and end homelessness in Wisconsin. And we've been talking about the state of homelessness help here in Wisconsin during a pandemic. Just ahead, we round up the Republican National Convention with 2 reporters, and we're taking your calls as we wrap things up. I'm Keeley Boltina. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.